White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 307.
It was the dawn of the third age of mankind, 10 years after the Earth-Minbari War. The Babylon Project was a dream given form. Its goal, to prevent another war by creating a place where humans and aliens could work out their differences peacefully. It's a port of call, home away from home for diplomats, hustlers, entrepreneurs, and wanderers. Humans and aliens wrapped in 2,500,000 tons of spinning metal, all alone in the night. It can be a dangerous place, but it's our last best hope for peace. This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2258. The name of the place is Babylon 5.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you, our great patrons at Patreon.com. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I haven't said that in a while, have I? That's kind of our catchphrase. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week we are joined once again by Jared Albrecht, the art director for White Rocket Books and also Yard Sale Artist on Twitter. Jared, welcome back aboard the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I can't wait to get my Babylon on, somewhere between 4 and 6.
Yes. Well,
let's go with five. Babylon 5.
Funny you should mention 4, but we'll get to that later.
All right.
Hopefully not as much time will pass, though, because I love season 1. We're still in the middle of season 1, and I love season 1 a lot for the episodic nature of it. It's like an old Star Trek show or something in season 1 with individual stories, you know, that kind of dominate that episode. But man, you know, knowing what's coming down the road, I'm in the car and the car is going like 30 on the interstate, and I'm just kind of like urging it, you know, come on, go forward. So we had a long layoff because you and I have been doing other things. We've had other shows, and we've had the of course Auburn football season. So John and I have to do the Wishbone every week, and that kind of takes up my prime Monday night podcast slot time. But we have an hour or so today, so I thought we could squeeze in 4 more episodes of Babylon 5, and then next time we'll come back and do more episodes of Quantum Leap. So this episode, we are covering Season 1, Episode 7, The War Prayer, Episode 8, And the Sky Full of Stars, Episode 9, Death Walker, and which sounds like a... sounds like Chuck Norris should be in that.
Yeah, Death Walker, Death Texas, Death Ranger.
And episode 10, The Very Divisive Believers. And that's one I have a story about, and there's a whole lot to say about that one. It's a very different episode than anything else in the entire history of the series.
It is interesting. I have thoughts on it, too. We'll get to it.
But yes, we will.
I'm interested.
Well, we start out with the War Prayer, which is not really considered one of the greatest episodes in Babylon 5 history, but as with many of the lesser episodes, and this is true of probably 90% of the episodes where the main plot is not that exciting, there's still some good character stuff, right? I mean, that's why I always tell people that are, you know, when people say, you know, I'm thinking about watching Babylon 5, should I skip whatever? And I'm like, well, you can skip the blah kind of episodes to get the main big story from all 5 seasons. But if you really want to get into it and appreciate, you know, Londo and appreciate Veer and appreciate Delenn, appreciate the various characters, you kind of have to watch the ones where the A plot is not the most exciting story ever, but there's still good character development stuff going on in the background that lends itself going forward. You know what I mean?
I do. You have a different look at it because you have the overall picture. You've seen it all before. You know where it's going. And I don't, so as I'm going through it, it's hard for me to tell what's
right,
a spinning their wheels episode and what's not.
Right.
And honestly, in this episode... War Prayer. Mm-hmm. I felt my instinct was that this was a world, more of a world building episode, to where we learn about the that the and I don't know if they're going to come more into play or not, but of the group that's very like xenophobic, like anti-alien group, and I got the feeling we might. This might be important to the larger story. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm right, but that's what I main bullet point I took from this episode was there's this group out there that's actively working against basically the mission of Babylon 5 to bring all these alien groups together in harmony, and there's a group that says, no, we don't want that. We want Earth only, right. And to a very violent extreme.
Yeah, Home Guard, and that's a very good point. They Home Guard is part of a larger. This isn't spoiling anything for episodes of the show, but yeah, Home Guard is part of a larger sort of movement going on among humans. I think it's easy. It's interesting that, you know, 20 something years ago, JMS was already thinking ahead to the idea of how societies could become fractured between those that are more xenophobic and those that are more outgoing. I mean, you know, you look at Europe after World War II, but roughly half of Europe is still kind of xenophobic and doesn't want people from other countries and other cultures coming in. The other half of Europe's very modern and progressive and open and welcomes everybody. And you get that friction, you know, you get that clash between the two groups that both have very heartfelt, sincere beliefs, but in completely opposite directions. And he sort of took that idea and said, you know, what would that be like when we get, would we be any different when we go out into space? And really, no, we're still exactly the same way. It's just that instead of, you know, illegal aliens, it's actually aliens. And right. I mean, in some ways, he was kind of prophetic about where American society is these days. So, you know, for better or for worse. So I just think it's really interesting how, you know, science fiction continues to both predict the future and sort of diagnose and suggest, you know, what we should do about it. So I think they do a really good job with that on this series.
Yeah, well, human nature is human nature,
right?
You know, and I think that's what makes really good sci-fi. Mm-hmm. You know, and you'd know better than me. You're a sci-fi mastermind. I am but a Padawan. but human nature is human nature, and it's not really ever going to change. And when you say it like that, it almost sounds bad, but it's not, like you were kind of saying, it's not necessarily bad, it's not necessarily good, it's just, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
And I mean, you can look at Star Trek, and and it's got the same thing, the human nature. You got your very practical Bones character, and you've got your much more open-minded, Kirk's more open-minded than Bones, but they need each other, you know, so it's human nature.
And that's one of the things that I have always sort of in some ways liked better about Babylon 5, even though I appreciate, I mean, I think you're right to a degree in terms of the main characters in Star Trek's universe, mm-hmm. but the Star Trek universe has always held that sort of utopian ideal from Gene Roddenberry that humans, as we go out into space and become more advanced in other ways, will also become more progressive and more open and less petty and less selfish and less childish and all that. Whereas Babylon 5 is the appeal of Babylon 5, it's kind of depressing in a way that it doesn't say we're, you know, Star Trek makes you feel better, right? Star Trek, you watch Star Trek and you think we have a glorious future where we leave our stupid adolescence behind and go out as a master race in the stars. That's a poor choice of words. Go out as a as a grown-up race. You know what I mean, right? Go up as a grown-up race.
I know exactly.
Yes.
We all have the common goal of getting together, being homogenous, and having sex with green chicks.
And Kirk waves the flag, leading the army. But on the other hand, Babylon 5 is kind of depressing in that way, and yet it's more realistic and in some ways more believable because Babylon 5 says no matter how far we go, we're still us. And
no, yeah, it's appealing. That's appealing.
And the bad guys on Babylon 5, a whole lot of them are humans. You know, a whole lot.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it does create an appeal. While it is a little dingier, you mm-hmm. know, than yeah. the clean Star yeah. Trek universe, it holds an appeal because it feels real. It all, in my opinion, again, you'd know better than me, all great science fiction takes what we know and what mm-hmm. our experiences and just puts it into a fantastical setting. Yeah. And it's very appealing. It's you know, I'm not saying again weird choices of words, but it's appealing because it feels real. It feels real. It feels like there's not a fantasy aspect to it.
Right. And I think that the original Star Trek did that in a very they did that about as well as you could do it in the 60s. You know, like,
yeah,
they had a lot of analogy episodes, right? They had, like, mm-hmm. the Vietnam War in space. They had racism in space. They had all the whatever blank in space episodes, but it was never the grand theme of the show. The grand theme of the show was, you know, humans can get their act together and be awesome. And that's very appealing. It's why I dearly love the original Star Trek. But Babylon 5 says, nah, we're still crap, you know, but here's what to worry about, and here's what to look for, and here's how we can still overcome it. And that's one of the great things about Babylon 5 is it presents us in a much darker light than Star Trek, and yet still shows us overcoming a lot of that stuff over the course of the story. And that I really like.
Yeah, it's almost like Star Trek is the end goal, and Babylon 5 is sort of that hump you have to get over to get there.
Yeah, it's the process. That's right. It is.
It really is. It's very well done. I'm really glad you put me onto the Babylon 5 program. I'm really liking it.
And it's only going to get better, I promise. So this episode is interesting because we have a lot of Minbari stuff going on. We have a lot of Centauri stuff going on. And so, therefore, Londo is kind of near the forefront. And Delenn is kind of near the forefront. And that's not something we get all the time where the ambassadors get the predominant attention. Very basically the summary, I guess, and I was just pointing out to Jared that he watched at least some of the episodes from this week's show like yesterday, whereas mm-hmm. I watched them about 9 months ago. So we're going to need the newbie to help the expert know what's going on, quote unquote, on this show.
The war prayer I watched about 6 months ago.
Right, right.
So we're both going to flounder on this first one, but the next ones I watched them last night.
Right. Cool. Well, yeah. There's basically two plots in this episode. If there's anything else I'm forgetting, but there's kind of three. This episode kind of has three B plots and no real A plot. The three main plots are Ivanova's old boyfriend comes back and visits, and he's Robert Scorpio from General Hospital, Tristan Rogers from Australia. Londo's relatives, I think, or they come to Babylon 5 looking for Londo's protection because they want to get married, and the rules aren't allowing them to. And then Delenn's friend, who is a poet, comes to the station, and she gets assaulted by the home guard, Earth fanatic kind of fascist dudes, who you later find out are tied in with Ivanova's boyfriend. So they connect the dots there a little bit. So it's kind of looking at xenophobia and the new, you know, younger people with new desires and thoughts versus people that are kind of living in the past and clinging to old stuff and all, in all three of those plots. So what are your thoughts about this episode as best you can remember it at this point in terms of the story and the characters and all that?
Like I said, it's been a while, but good shows, movies, TV shows, whatever, certain things will stick with you. If it wasn't good, I wouldn't remember anything. So that's a sign that it was good because I watched it 6 months ago, and I do remember the plot of the arranged marriage. Apparently, Londo's people, the Centauri, have arranged marriages still. And so I remember the plot of the two young lovers that wanted to marry for love, and Londo was, as usual, fairly hilarious in his responses to that as he tried to sort of navigate the waters of this is the old way we do it, but you could tell he had a soft spot in his heart for wanting that to change. So I remember that vividly, and I obviously remember the home guard, mm-hmm. the xenophobic sort of very anti-alien neo-Nazi group, if you
right.
will.
Yeah.
I said that was one of my biggest takeaways. I felt like that episode was trying to say, hey, this is a faction that we may be dealing with mm-hmm. throughout the series. Yeah. They're making things more difficult. And at first I kind of I didn't really know what they were. So I kind of liked the Home Guard because I thought they were anti-poetry, and I'm okay with that.
Great.
But then I found out it was all about aliens, and I felt bad. No, I'm just kidding. If you're a poet and you listen to the show, that was just a joke. I'm okay with poetry. But yeah, so those were my big takeaways, was sort of the quasi fun story with Londo and the two young lovers, and then the world build of the home guard. You know, this is something we may have to deal with in the future. And I always get a kick out of this too, because whether you're watching apparently Babylon 5 or any Star Trek, no matter what version of it, it's like almost every time that one of our female leads has a boyfriend show up, he almost inevitably becomes a jerk. Like, yeah. There's almost always something wrong with him.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I'm like, well, here we go again. This guy was a jerk. So, yeah, those were my big takeaways.
Yeah, and I want to point out, by the way, I like how the costume and makeup design people, because as I always point out, especially in the first season, Babylon 5 was produced on like $1.75 an episode. I mean, they had no money. And so I like how the shorthand for the Centauri, because the Centauri on the outside, at least what we can see, there's other stuff, but at least what we can see, they look just like humans. So their shorthand is they have the big hair like Londo, and they wear vests. I like that the Centauri always wear vests. It's like this cultural thing with them. They just love vests. They're always wearing these vests. So when you see a guy with a hair sticking up and a vest, you know it's a Centauri, no matter what they look like, right? Yep. And it's kind of interesting. And the women, of course, are bald because they shave their heads to rise above, as I think one of Londo's wives puts it. So they always have the little headband on, so the actress doesn't have to shave her head to do, you know, 45 minutes of a show with no money. But yeah, we get a great line from Londo where he doesn't want to help him at first, I believe, and then he tells Veer later he's upset and he says, "My shoes are too tight and I've forgotten how to dance." And I guess what he means by this, one of the more obscure things to me that Londo ever says. Usually he's more direct, but I think what he's saying is he says his father, I believe, told that to him one time, and he had never had any idea what his father meant until now. And I think what he's saying is, when you get old enough and you've been in the bureaucracy and you've had to do stuff by the book, by the book, by the book, it gets very constrictive and you forget how to just be happy and joyful and to like help people like these two kids that want to be happy. So he feels kind of suffocated, I think, and he's trying.
Yeah.
So he changes his mind and helps him as best he can. That's kind of cool. And it's good it's good to see Londo doing something good and positive, because he has his moments where he's pretty bad, you know. So
he's still my favorite. But
yeah,
I love that part where he said, "You know, I did my part, and I've had three arranged marriages, and they were all great sacrifices." Yeah. That's the line that stuck with me. He calls his three marriages great sacrifices.
Great sacrifices, right? Oh, just you wait. But I don't think we've had. No, we haven't. Never mind. You just
I have not seen the spouse of Londo, if that's where we're going.
Oh, my goodness. We've seen his girlfriend, though, right? We've seen his mistress.
I have seen his girlfriend.
Yes.
And I approve.
Yes, the dancing girl. Yeah. Adira.
Adira.
Ah, oh, Adira. Yes, Adira.
Londo, we should do a whole episode on Adira.
We should do a whole episode just talking like Londo. I actually had Peter Jurassic at Dragon Con 1 year trying to instruct me on how to say my good dear friend Mr. Garibaldi, because I wasn't doing it quite right. He's like, no. He's like, Peter Jurassic's the nicest guy, and I was just hanging out with him for a little while in Dragon Con in the bar, and he goes, no, my good dear friend Mr. Garibaldi. I see, I still can't do it right, but that's kind of how he was doing it. Like, every syllable gets its own full diaphragm pronunciation, you know, and you have to do your hands like you're grabbing something from underneath while you say it. So it's pretty cool. But yeah, Londo is a character. He's so interesting because when the show first starts, as you were seeing on the pilot episode, you know, the gathering, Londo is he's a clown. He's there for laughs, you know, yuck, yuck. But he really does get fleshed out, even in season one, that you see kind of what motivates him, why he puts on that persona. It's a facade, right? And you start to get a better sense of him as a multidimensional character. And that really helps. It's the same thing with Jakar, although it takes a little longer, I think, for us to see, you know, Jakar's depth. We kind of see Jakar is A, very hostile when he needs to be, but then also B, very noble when he needs to be. And we kind of get those two extremes of him, and it takes a while to fill in the middle with Jakar. Whereas I would say that with Londo, we see the whole gray area filling out very quickly. Do you agree, or I'm not sure how much we've seen so far?
No, I would agree. I feel like I'm getting more of a grasp on his character. I feel like I know where we're going with Jakar. Mm. And I know I do this a lot, and I apologize for every time, but Star Trek analogies. Mm. I feel Jakar is very Klingon-y in that he's very aggressive, but he also has that tremendous sense of honor where if a Klingon says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. Mm. And I like that. I find that appealing. I feel like we're being set up for him to make some maybe surprising things that you wouldn't expect him to do, but very loaded with honor. So I'm kind of excited about that. Hopefully that'll come to pass. And then, like you said, with Londo, I feel he's very Quark-like, and Quark is my favorite character, by the way, mm-hmm. in Star Trek. So, yeah, he's very sort of surface level. He looks sort of cheap and flashy and just there for the laughs, but there's a lot more going on under the surface, and we saw that in this episode.
That's right.
You know, we got to see his heart. So I'm taken with both of those characters very much. They're probably – no, not probably. They definitely are my favorite two characters from the show.
That's probably what a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people that feel that way. They were always very, very popular, and it's because I think in part they get so much development. I mean, JMS clearly loves them, and the actors were great. I mean, those two actors
yes.
are fantastic.
Yes.
They have great chemistry together, and it just everything was in their favor for them to be, you know, bigger and bigger and more developed and more important as the show goes along. So, I don't have a lot else to say about this episode other than I think at one point we see Kosh watching human history on his like TV, on his widescreen TV in his smoke-filled chambers, his gas-filled chambers. And Sinclair...
I'll believe that, sure.
I think this is where Sinclair goes to him to ask him for help with something. And Kosh is like, let me see if I can find the quote. Where he says, like Sinclair goes to him and says, it might be helpful if you spoke with the other ambassadors. And Kosh says, we take no interest in the affairs of others. And he says that while he's watching a big TV showing human history. So Kosh, you're a big liar
liar.
in a shower box thing.
You know what? I just remembered, and this is not associated with Kosh. Didn't Londo nickname his three wives after like Horsemen of the Apocalypse?
Yes, yes. Pestilence, Famine, and Death, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And interestingly, people then pointed out that left out war. Ooh.
What is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Say it again.
But yeah, so that's the war prayer. And it's an interesting episode. Again, it's more about the more character stuff, I think, than it really is bigger plot. Now let's go to 108, episode 108, and The Sky Full of Stars, because this is a plot episode. This is hitting us really
over the
head with what happened to Jeffrey Sinclair at the Battle of the Line and his missing 24 hours and all that kind of stuff, because these two agents of EarthGov, I guess they were working for EarthGov, who were they working for? I can't even remember.
That's a fine question because I was unclear as well. I thought at first they were the Home Guard, but they never said. So.
And you'd think
if they did say, I just missed it.
And if they were official agents of EarthGov, you'd think that they would just recall Sinclair back to Earth and interrogate him rather than sending these two random dudes out to, you know, mess with him. But anyway, I'm sure that all the people that have watched it more recently than me or have a better memory than me are like screaming at their iPhones or whatever right now. But but in any case, these two agents, Night 1 and Night 2, show up. And here's an interesting little something I just happen to know, trivia. Originally, Walter Koenig, Chekhov, was cast as the night guy in this episode, the one that's doing the main one, Night 2.
Right.
And he was something was wrong. He had a physical illness and was unable to do this one episode. And because of that, JMS just said, well, we'll call you in for something else later. And he ends up, I know they filmed it earlier, but when they were casting before they started filming, this happened, and he couldn't do this one. So they ended up putting him in as Bester instead. Bester was like his consolation role, and of course, it works out much better for Walter Koenig and for us that that he got to be Bester instead of this guy, because this guy was kind of a throwaway, whereas Bester is a great character, and you have not seen the last of him. So so it works out really well that this actor, Christopher Neame, plays Knight 2. So
I thought Christopher Neame did a great job while we're on the topic.
No, yeah, he was great.
He did a good job, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not a role that really has a lot of future to it, basically.
Right.
I can't even and by the way, did you recognize Judson Scott as Knight 1?
Yeah, I saw that guy and I went, I know him from somewhere, and I never pieced the puzzle together. It was bugging me. So if you want to piece it together for me now, you go right ahead.
That would be Joachim from Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Thank you. That was bugging me. I was like, I know this guy. And our the funny thing is, my brain even went into a Star Trek gear, but it never clicked.
Our shields are dropping. Raise them. I can't. I love it. You will be avenged.
You go ahead and do the whole radio show probably, of episode, if you want.
The whole movie, yeah. I'm trying to think if there was a B-plot in this one.
It was almost exclusively him being, you know, lawnmower manned, as I call it. I'm trying to think about B-plot. Other than like them looking for him, you know, it'd go from that, you know, the other Babylon 5 people looking for Sinclair was kind of the B plot, if I remember correctly.
Right, I think you're right. So Sinclair ends up basically kidnapped and being mentally held hostage by these guys, and they want to know what happened to him at the Battle of the Line for those 24 hours. And it makes sense that EarthGov or whoever would want to know this. Because here he is, we find out in this episode, I believe, right, that he was handpicked over like 50 people that were senior to him in the chain of command. Because every time EarthGov would nominate somebody to run Babylon 5, the Minbari would veto them. And they vetoed and vetoed and vetoed until they got all the way down to Sinclair. And the Minbari are like, yeah, he'll do. And EarthGov is like, well, why do they want him and nobody else? Well, he was at the Battle of the Line and fought the Minbari, and he disappeared for 24 hours. So, it makes perfect sense that flags would go up, questions would be raised about why do our implacable enemies from 5 minutes ago, or 10 years ago now, want this guy to be the commander of this station they're building with us, when, of all the people there, he's the one that actually disappeared while fighting them, right? So, that makes sense to me.
Well, I don't think they hit that very specific point home as much as you maybe think, because it's been a while since you've seen this episode. Mm-hmm. They went greatly into detail about his, well, vaguely and greatly into detail
about
his missing 24 hours. But they really didn't hit on that point of them skipping over tons of people to get to him to be the leader of Babylon 5 yet. I know it's coming because we've discussed that.
Right.
But I don't think they hit that hard in this episode.
I think there's an episode later in this season called Eyes where that comes up very strongly. And I was thinking they'd already mentioned it. But okay. But yeah, it's not a big – it's just an aside. But I'm saying you could understand why these guys would want to know what the deal is with Sinclair.
Yes.
And so what all – help us remember, because, again, I haven't seen it in a while. What all do they see and learn when they probe his mind? Walk us through that.
They basically – you see him as the squad leader at the Battle of the Line. Mm-hmm. And slowly throughout the episode, you piece together that – you know, he was there with his friend, like Mitchell, I think his name was, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Mitchell tried to save him and ended up getting destroyed. And next thing you know, Admiral Akbar would say, "It's a trap."
Yeah.
It was a big trap, and there was a giant battle cruiser there, I guess, that they didn't expect. And to be honest with you, just as a side note, tangent, we've talked about their shoestring budget. Their CGI graphics, which were okay, almost kind of hindered them in this episode. It was – maybe it helped, maybe it hindered, because it was difficult to tell what was going on. Maybe that's the point because it's a fuzzy memory. Anyway, they're in the middle of a trap. Sinclair sees the big warship and basically decides everyone's dying, so he's going to kamikaze it. He starts to kamikaze the warship, and all of a sudden basically his ship gets frozen. The next thing he knows, he's inside. He's been tortured, and he's surrounded by like seven or eight people in gray robes.
Mm-hmm.
He approaches and challenges one of them to see that it was Delenn, and that's all we know. And then she asked him after he got out of his Lawnmower Man episode what he remembered, and he lied to her and said he didn't remember anything, but he remembered that she was there.
You were there, and you were there, and you were there. Yeah, yeah, and they don't. The Minbari did not want Sinclair to remember that Delenn was there. Because
no, they did not.
Because
they said they told her that if he does remember, she's to kill him.
Yeah. It's interesting because Delenn is just a lowly ambassador to the Babylon 5 station. I mean,
no.
That's all she is.
No.
She has no greater significance to the Minbari. She's like a bureaucrat way down the totem pole, right?
I don't believe that for a second. I have suspicions on her. I have suspicions on Kosh. I think Kosh is one of those characters who's less than you think he is.
Hmm.
I think he's Wizard of Oz style, less than you think he is, but we'll see.
Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it, is that Sinclair is starting to remember things a little bit, but he certainly doesn't want the Minbari to know he's remembering anything because, like you said, God forbid they should find out he's remembering. They might take extreme measures. Let's see, what else about this episode do we need to talk about? I mean, it's certainly a big episode. It's one of those where it seems like it has more impact than it really does, because it does tell us, you know, what Sinclair was doing at the Battle of the Line. It does tell us that there's, you know, there are repressed memories, that he did go on board the ship, that he did meet these people in gray robes. That could be significant, that he did see Delenn there. And then they let him go.
Mm-hmm. And then he wakes up and they've surrendered.
And they've, yes. Oh, that's slightly important, right?
I would imagine so.
They were about to defeat and destroy the whole Earth and wipe out the human race. They kidnap him. They abduct him. They interrogate him. And then they surrender.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, this thought I have about that is the thought I have about this episode overall, in that it's like I think you were alluding to just a minute ago. It's an episode that doesn't really, it fills in a couple of blanks, but the main purpose of the episode is really to say, hey, everyone, there's a big mystery here. You know,
there's
a big mystery that everyone should pay attention to. We've hinted at it. We're putting the limelight on it. There's a mystery. We're going to give you a couple of little pieces of it. But yeah, you know, there's a lot more to come, you know, and that's just good storytelling. So, yeah, I mean, why did they surrender? What did they specifically do to Sinclair? Why only gray? Why can't they get, you know, a purple bathrobe or Argyle?
They are gray. I'm sorry. They would not wear any other colors because we are gray. I can't say anything else. I can't say anything. It'd be a spoiler if I said anything else, but
all right.
We are gray.
The only other kind of takeaway I had, which it wasn't, I don't know what's huge and what's not. It didn't seem huge, but I liked the character development, was the discussion early in the episode, I think, that Dr. Franklin had with Delenn.
Yeah.
Where he admitted to her that he had been basically tasked by the government to create biological weapons against their species.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's a doctor and he takes that so seriously, he destroyed his notes, which gives you a good character insight to
absolutely
to Franklin, what his priorities are, which we are going to see soon in an episode we're about to discuss.
Yeah. And I think that's a very important point, which is that we learn now that Franklin is willing to go against the Earth government based on his principles. That's something to file away.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you made a good point about how they're reintroducing the fact that there's this mystery with Sinclair, because not everybody saw the pilot. And so, you know, for the first few episodes...
And even if you did, it's easy to miss that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And so for the first few episodes, he's just been like the Captain Kirk guy. But in this episode, it's like, hey, don't forget, he's got a whole weird thing going on too, you know. So it was kind of, I think, mm-hmm. useful to kind of re-up the mystery on Sinclair. Which is very connected, apparently, to the Minbari. And that too, is going to be significant later because, you know, as you go through 5 seasons of a show, it starts to become somewhat implausible that every galactic mystery can be tied to the same random human person, And so it's not a bad thing, let's just say, because you know this is coming, when you change lead actors, say.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's just say that, let's say that all five years of Captain Kirk's five-year voyage, every year some big galactic mystery was tied to the captain of the Enterprise. Wouldn't it be a little more plausible if there were different captains, each had their own mystery, rather than the same guy has every galactic mystery tied to him?
I suppose so, but that's a lot for my simple mind to keep track of.
Okay.
So, well, I think you've answered a question that I have and I've never asked outright. Because remember when we first started this, you were like, what do you know about Babylon 5? And I was like, I know it stars Bruce Boxleitner, and now here I am, how many episodes deep? I'm like, where the hell is Bruce Boxleitner? And you say, he's coming. And I think you told me maybe like something in the actor's life of Sinclair was personally went bad.
Yeah.
And there's a tragedy involved there. Here's the question I had is, so Bruce Boxleitner is going to be a new character?
Yes.
He's not taking over as Sinclair.
No, not at all.
Okay. And all right, I was just wondering about that.
The character of Sinclair is still viable in the Babylon 5 story after Boxleitner comes in. He doesn't just cease to exist or become a different actor. No, he's still out there in the world, so in the universe.
Okay.
Here's an interesting
thing. He's running around with Mrs. King.
Here's an interesting
little scarecrow and Mrs. King joke for everybody in the audience.
I caught that. Yeah, you're actually not far off, but I won't go there. I thought this was interesting. I saw a list of what was on the Universe Today newspaper in this episode, and I thought, and by the way, if Babylon 5 had really been on the ball, instead of reading those future newspapers, they'd have had them on their iPads, you know.
Definitely.
But
I didn't notice this, though. So go on. What did you notice?
I noticed it in passing, but here's like an actual list where they wrote it down. And there's some very interesting stuff here they crammed onto the front page of Universe Today. Sports, 0G tennis results inside. Okay, well, whatever. Is there something living in hyperspace? Home guard leader convicted. Oh.
Yeah.
Narn Settle Ragesh 3 controversy. That's back to the first episode. EA president promises balanced budget by 2260. Okay. PsyCorps in election tangle. Did PsyCorps violate its charter by endorsing the vice president? San Diego still considered too radioactive for occupancy. That's actually a headline from today. Just kidding. After the Chargers left. I don't know if you realize it, but in the Babylon 5 world, San Diego was nuked years ago.
I'm picking that up from this newspaper headline.
Yeah, we found that out in bits and pieces over time. People mentioned it in passing, the San Diego wasteland.
Somebody just really hates the zoo? Or I guess I'll learn more.
I don't know. Special section, pros and cons of interspecies mating. Clearly, this is written by J.T. Kirk. Yes, editorial.
Right. It's an op-ed.
Op-ed from the Federation, right.
And it's just one line. It says, that is awesome. That's all it says.
Exactly. That's the pro side, yeah. But with periods after each word, so you do it in a hesitant fashion.
That is awesome.
Yes. And then copyright trial continues in Book Zap Flap. Books downloaded directly into brain. Who owns them? Which you could kind of see that with Kindle and everything that would be coming in the future. So there you go. I thought that was very interesting that they were able to squeeze a few future references in among the false leads.
It's pretty neat
there.
That they took the time to put a little, you know, that detail in there. I like that.
Yeah, there's a couple of, I won't say which ones, but there's a couple there that are important. And there's a couple that are just backstory, and then a couple that are stupid.
I want to know more about this mating thing.
Yeah, that's the one that's important, absolutely. Right. You wouldn't have Mr. Spock otherwise. Let me pause here, and as we move out of 108, we got to thank our patrons. If you want to support shows like this and the AU Wishbone and On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast and stuff, and all these various shows, we certainly welcome your support, and we'll mention your name if you so desire. I haven't yet to have anybody say, please don't mention my name. So So therefore, I mention the names. Here are our supporters that have, that keep our shows on the air. Nicholas Cottrell, Joseph Fine, Neil Dyer, Phil M. Thor of WeHaveDonuts.com. WeHaveDonuts.com.
Delicious.
David Evers, Tom Anderson, Timothy, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Steve Harlan, Richard Stevens, Andrew Barber, some Jared Albrecht guy.
Woo!
Rich Reimer, Bill Matthews, John McCune, David Simpson, Josh Teal, Mike Finley, Randall Walker, C.T. Wayne, Earl Ricks, Dave Powell, Michael Kirshner, Mick Vigencana, Chris Thrash, J.W. Rice, Wardam Wade, Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, and Russell Milling, as well as our awesome one-time anonymous donors. We thank you guys so much. That's a nice little list, but we still need more. So go to patreon.com, patreon.com, and just type in Plexico, Plexico, and it'll take you right to me. You should see my name pop up as a little clickable thing. Or you can just go to www.plexico.net. That is now the central hub website for all the stuff that I do in association with White Rocket and books and so forth. So you can see all of the various White Rocket books. You can see links to the comic book that that Jared and I are working on feverishly. You can, or it's going to be there anyway. We have a placeholder now that's pretty cool. You can link to the Patreon page directly to my to the White Rocket Patreon page from there. Link to just about anything that's associated with me, with the podcast, with White Rocket books and all that. So patreon.com/VanAllenPlexico. Or www.plexico.net. Okay, you want to go?
I'm glad you brought that up because I just remembered that I inked page like 18 or 19 yesterday, forgot to scan it to the colorist. If you hadn't said something, now I know I got to go scan some pages of our comic book.
I'm just so excited. It's just rolling right along. I mean,
it is getting there. I have one other question about the Patreon, though.
Yeah.
You said I had to donate if I wanted to co-host shows. But yet I don't hear true. John Ringer's name in
that's,
the Patreon.
That's not true. It's not true at all. That's not true at all.
He's
just making this up. No, I told you that I would edit you out of shows if you...
That's what it was.
So, okay. Jared, what do you think about that?
Dead silence.
I'll go back and retroactively remove you if you ever unsubscribe. Yeah. No. So that was pretty much 108, The Sky Full of Stars, and it, you know, like I said, it advanced a little bit, The Big Mystery. So now we get into one that is, I think that 109, Deathwalker, I think this is an interesting kind of okay episode for most of its length, but near the end we get one of my favorite moments in the entire series. But first, did you recognize two sci-fi veteran actresses in this episode? They were both in makeup, so you may not have.
Okay, the lady who played Deathwalker herself.
Yes.
Deathwalker. She was well made up, so I had a vibe that I know this person from somewhere, but I did not pin it down.
J'adore.
That was Sarah Douglas, one of the Kryptonian villains from Superman 2.
Boom.
Yeah. Pretty cool. And Ambassador Kalika, the little fish lady that was...
Right. She had a ton of makeup on. So, yeah. that didn't even buzz the bell for me.
She's the one that was, like, with Dalin wanting to do something about all this. That right. was Robin Curtis, the replacement Savick from Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. That's a ton of makeup. I never would have picked that up. But, okay, yeah. I got you.
Yeah. So we had a couple of big, fairly medium-sized, big-time sci-fi actresses there. I like how Babylon 5, A, would pilfer from Star Trek actors quite often. I love that. I mean, from Walter Koenig and Majel Barrett all the way down to people like Sarah Douglas. I mean Robin Curtis. And also they would get, other... one of the things I love about the guest actors on Babylon 5, too, is they love to use British actors as aliens. And there's like an expat community of British actors, apparently, in Los Angeles that will just do any show, And so they just cycle through. We get there's so like, many. Yeah, we just get so many... different British actors that appear on soap operas and whatever else, and then they pop up as an alien for like one episode on here, and it's pretty cool. Later, we'll also see what's his name from Breaking Bad?
Bryan Cranston?
Bryan Cranston pops up for one episode too, yeah, in a very minor role.
Huh. All right. So he'd been more like the guy from Malcolm in the Middle when this was coming out.
Yes, exactly. It may have been before that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, actually, this was before that, now that I think
about it. Yeah, so. Well, let's see. This one, the notorious war criminal Jadur, or Deathwalker.
Deathwalker.
Yeah, she shows up. And, by the way, this is a Larry DiTillo episode, and I did not used to appreciate Larry DiTillo's writing because it's, you know, the JMS episodes are like The Sky Full of Stars or Soul Hunter, you know, where there's this action adventure or mystery and suspense. The Larry DiTillo, and he only writes episodes pretty much in season one and then he goes his separate ways. I think he was the story editor for JMS. DiTillo episodes tend to have the more slightly goofy stuff. Let me mention like the C-plot real quick. Ambassador Kosh hires Talia Winters, everybody's favorite cute blonde telepath, to oversee his negotiations with this guy called Abbott the Vicar. And that is such a Larry DiTillo... Anything where they mention a Jovian sunspot drink is always Larry DiTillo. JMS would not even do that. But Larry DiTillo loved the idea of the Jovian sunspot. But anyway, let's just talk about that little subplot first. What did you take from Ambassador Kosh having a nonsensical conversation? Oh, and by the way, I think you get more dialogue from Kosh in this episode than in the entire rest of the series put together. He's just a motor mouth.
What did I take from this plot? Yeah, okay. So you had mysterious Kosh talking with the illegitimate son of Prince and Zorro, talking like nonsensical phrases.
Right.
I had a suspicion early on in the episode when she was like, none of this is making sense. Why am I here? My immediate suspicion was this has nothing to do with them and everything to do with you.
Yeah.
And that's even though they didn't flat out say that, they came very close to it near the end of basically they were it was heavily hinted at that Kosh was basically storing her greatest fears on a chip
for the future.
For the future.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, I mean, if terrorizing young blonde mind readers is your thing, then good work, dude.
Good on you, yeah.
But I'm sure it's a piece to a grander puzzle. At least I hope it is. Otherwise, I'm going to be ticked that I wasted that much brain power thinking about it.
I need to make a note to talk about that later. But yeah, I can't say anything now. But man,
Yeah, I bet you do. My only other thought was that the son of Prince and Zorro guy, she was like, she couldn't read anything on him at all. So I was like, my whole thing was, is he an android? Mm. And I was kind of close. He had like an android protection thing around his brain, like a robot something around his brain.
Because
he takes his hat off and you can see his brain with this mechanical device around it.
Exactly. I can tell you this because it's not going to ever matter again. When that was in the show, JMS said later, he says, somebody asked him something like, why did we never see him again or that character or that kind of character or whatever? And JMS said, I decided I didn't want that kind of technology in my universe. So the whole Abbott the Vicar with the hat thing, he personally doesn't really go anywhere after this because JMS just decided he didn't like it. And I'm okay with that because it was a very Larry DiTillo thing. And once DiTillo leaves the show, it's not like JMS was going to bring that character back, you know? So don't worry about him. Now, the other stuff that goes on in that plot, it might be more interesting later, but then again, it might not. But the Vicar, yeah, JMS just didn't like it and thought he was kind of regretted even having that character be like that.
He was like wacky, you know.
Yeah.
He was obviously a wacky character that almost felt like he was from a different show. But I think all your sci-fis and when I say all, I mean Star Trek, because those are the ones I watch. But, like, every once in a while, they bring in that character. And I could see where, on one hand, JMS is like, he doesn't fit in our universe. And big like you said, some fans are divided on this guy. Maybe they don't like him. It's very obviously a DiTilio thing, apparently. But on the other hand, it breaks up the monotony of this real serious stuff all the time. So that's, it's kind of nice to see a goofy character every once in a while.
That's true.
And it can't always be Londo. So
yeah,
I'm okay with
that's
it.
That's fair.
Overall.
Did you get the reference to his name? Because it occurred to me at the time, and I thought, well, that couldn't be it. But later on, I saw an interview. I've got a...
an Abbott and Costello thing?
Maybe for the name Abbott, but he's Abbott the Vicar.
Right. Oh, because they did say that it was based off of the word VCR, because he was recording.
Oh, okay. He did say that. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, they mentioned it in the show. They said it's a reference to an old technology called a VCR, because he records things.
Right. Okay. I didn't remember if that was in the show or that was in an interview. I've got a Cine Fantastique magazine from back in the day where they actually, like, after Babylon 5 was done, they went and did, like, this whole, like, giant 200-page issue with just super in-depth discussion of the whole series. And they have a good long interview with DiTilio in it, and I couldn't remember if he was talking about it in there or not. And by the way, folks out there, if you're a big Babylon 5 fan and you don't have that, get a hold of it by any means possible, because it's a great resource. It's just got tons of interviews and tons of analysis and everything. I've got basically every Babylon 5 work of literature that was ever done. I've got the Babylon Files 2-volume analysis books. I've even got I did a video about this a while back, Jared. I've got a book that a British university put out after they did a weekend symposium on Babylon 5 as, like, you know, literature, basically. And it's you got to be really into a show to want the academic seminar book about the conference. You know what I mean? But I have it.
I have a Peter David novel called In the Beginning from Babylon 5.
Yes.
That I found at a library sale.
That's not a bad book. It's a novelization of the movie that we're going to get to coming up down the road a bit.
Oh, okay. I also have some old Penthouse forums.
which is apropos of nothing. Just you thought you'd throw that out, right? All right. Let's see. So just to kind of quickly get through the main plot here, she has developed – she was a part of the Dilgar. And from the backstory, we learned that the Dilgar were this really aggressive, evil race that were enslaving all the non-aligned worlds. And when Earth went out into the galaxy and started being a butt-kicking race, we were like the Americans showing up in World War II and beating the Nazis, right? We helped take down the Dilgar, which is one of the reasons why we had the goodwill of those non-aligned races, you know, the ones that they're in the council chamber, like the mm-hmm. Game and the Vree and I can't remember them all, the Pachmara and all them. We got their goodwill because we beat the space Nazis, basically. And so she's like the last death camp Mingala, you know, Nazi Dilgar, but it's like, what if a Nazi war criminal shows up with the secret of immortality? You know, what do you do then? It's a great question. And what happens, of course, is that all the various races start squabbling and maneuvering to be the one to get the secret. But then what do you find out about this secret? Like, how does it work?
Oh, that was a big reveal. Yes, you find out that in order to make this everlasting life substance, you have to take it from living beings. You have to kill living beings
mm-hmm.
to make the substance, which to me, that was the biggest moment in the episode when she revealed that. And she was like, yeah, so, you know, because they'd mocked her earlier about her, you know, just basically wanting to put her stamp on history and have a monument. And she was like, that's my monument. If you use this, mm-hmm. you become us.
Right.
Have a good day. And I was like, damn, that's a deep burn. That is a deep burn.
That's good. Yeah, I love that. I think it's brilliant. I mean, this episode is kind of gray. I mean, some people really like it and some people make fun of it and don't like it. I think it's an excellent one. I think it's really good.
I loved it. I loved it.
And I think it's a great moral question it poses. And I like how when they reveal that, it's like all the various races, they pause for half a second and think, and then they're like, that's okay. And they keep trying to get it. You know, it's like they don't go, oh, well, in that case, we forswear it forever. No, they're like, okay, it's all right. That's an acceptable cost, you know.
Was it Kosh that ended up having it destroyed?
No, that's my part that I love the most. Yeah, so they go through the whole thing, and at the end, when it's, I forget even what ship it's on, I can't remember. They put her and the secret on a ship, and they're being carried off to, is it Earth Alliance or something? I think so. One of the races wins and is going to get it, and off she goes, and then boom, here comes the jump gate opens, and a Vorlon cruiser comes out, blows her ship to hell, turns around and flies back away again. Everybody's just standing there with their mouths hanging open, and they look at Kosh, and Kosh says, "You are not ready for immortality." And he just drops the mic and walks away. Because
I'm going for a sandwich.
Yeah, and they're just like, okay. Because all when right. That's one of the things I love about it. When the Vorlons decide anything, that's it. You know, like, you can spend an hour having all the different races arguing about something, and then the Vorlons just walk in and put their quote-unquote foot down and say, no, it's going to be like this, and everybody's like, you got it.
I'm still calling it Paper Tiger. I'm still calling it Smoke and Mirrors.
that's an interesting take, and I do like it. I'm very intrigued by that. I think that's an interesting idea. And I totally swear you're coming from on it, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I just like how the Vorlons in this particular instance settle the argument by just saying, you know, in our opinion, none of you get it. Everybody loses. They're like the anti-Oprah. You lose immortality, and you lose immortality, and you lose immortality. And
then your life is finite, and your life is finite.
Yes, and then just walk away. So, yeah, Kosh is awesome in this. I love that. I love what it also says, because up until this point, you could be excused for thinking the Vorlons are just one of the alien powers. I mean, in terms of their power, okay? After this episode, you're kind of like, okay, they're kind of like in the major leagues. Everybody else is in AA, you know?
Yeah, they're at the very least, they're doing whatever they want to do, and they don't care.
And they don't care.
They just don't care.
And you got to think, if they are the only alien race that can do that, then they're pretty dangerous. But fortunately, they just don't seem to care, and they only show up when they feel like... I mean, they're almost like Superman, right? Where they could take over the world, you know, it seems like, but they only show up when there's something really bad they need to fix, and then they fly away. If that's what they are, if the Vorlons are basically like Superman, you can live with them as long as they, you know, are benign. But what if they're not the only race that's that powerful? Or what if they decide not to be benign? I mean, there's interesting questions that this raises. And I'm not saying any of these go anywhere or not. I'm just saying this is the kind of thing I thought about when I watched this episode is, are they the only ones this powerful? And do we want one alien race to be this powerful? And are they benign, you know? Because they're not even benign. They're just kind of apathetic up till this, right? So this was a big moment to me when they stopped being apathetic for 5 seconds. So...
there's definitely a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff. Let's see. Lastly, and we'll wrap up here in a few minutes, this episode 110, Believers. All right, I got to tell my quick personal story for this episode. When I recently rewatched it back a few months ago, I was so intrigued by it as a standalone story completely separate from Babylon 5 that I recorded it and I showed it to my religion class back in the spring just to see what they thought about it. Because I thought my religion students would get something out of this in a different way than I did when I first watched it. And they enjoyed it and we had a good conversation. Now let me back up. When this episode first aired back in 1994, when I was living in Auburn, going to graduate school.
War Eagle.
I had seen, you know, Parliament of Dreams, which was awesome. I had seen Sky Full of Stars, which is pretty cool. I saw Deathwalker, which is pretty cool. I was loving this show. This was becoming like my favorite show already. A bunch of my friends were in town, and they came over, and I'm like, I just recorded Babylon 5 last night. This is the best new show. It's so cool. So let's watch this new episode. I haven't seen it yet, but let's watch it. It was Believers. 15 minutes in, they're all like, man, this sucks. Turn this crap off. And I'm just like, oh. Babylon 5, why are you doing me this way? I wanted space battles and aliens and Londo being funny, and instead I get, do we save the little boy that's sick? This was not what you showed a group of guys in town to hang out for the weekend, you know?
To depends on the group of guys.
Well, that's true. But I was so disappointed in this episode, and I just hated it.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. It wasn't. It was outside of the normal flavor,
right?
You know, and I'm only what 10? What is this? 12?
10, 13? 10 plus the pilot. Yeah.
Yeah, episodes deep, and I could tell. Okay, this is a step away from the usual formula. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, Jared's the kind of guy that appreciates those things.
Yeah,
he appreciates every once in a while a let's step away from that to examine this really mm-hmm. closely for a minute, and then we'll come back. You know, so I get your point though. Like you wanted to give them a flavorful episode.
I wanted Star Wars, and I got like the most.
And, you got an episode of MASH.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And you know, watching it again in the context of not trying to impress, you know, drinking buddies, but just trying to watch it in the context of a cool sci-fi show, I really liked it. Like I said, I liked it enough to even show it to my students. So
I loved it.
I liked it much better this time than I did the first time. But for 20 years, I just hated it. Now, did you see who wrote it?
No, but I can look it up now on the internet. David Gerald?
David Gerald. Most famously, he wrote The Trouble with Tribbles.
Ah, okay.
And he's still around. I bump into him occasionally on Facebook now and then. He's a very active writer. He's come back into prominence recently with the movie about him and his little boy that came out. I think it was called The Martian. No, not The Martian, but it was something like that. There's a movie that came out about him and his adopted son that he wrote, and it was very powerful. It came out like a year or two ago, and it got a lot of attention. But anyway, he kind of comes in and out of prominence every few years, but he's most famous for The Trouble with Tribbles. He was one of the story editors on Star Trek: The Next Generation for a couple of years too, at the beginning. But he wrote this, and walk us through what you thought about this episode, kind of quick what happens and what you thought about it, because I think everybody would be curious to hear what somebody that's never encountered it before really thought about it.
Okay. Essentially, this episode is about Dr. Franklin, and he is wants to save this child from a different alien race with a very simple surgery, and that alien race forbids any kind of surgery. You cannot cut open the body. It desecrates the body. They think it lets the spirit out,
mm-hmm.
and that you become basically a shell and a worthless thing with no spirit. And Franklin is approaching this from, you know, Earth standpoint, medical standpoint. He just wants to save this child, and the parents want to save the child too, but they have that strict religious belief. So that's really where all the tension comes from. Franklin tries to get Sinclair to okay the surgery. Sinclair is hesitant to do that because he doesn't want to step on the religious beliefs and rights of the alien parents. And the alien parents try to get all the various ambassadors to take up their case. Nobody wants it. Mm-hmm. So it's very sort of complex politically. And ultimately what happens is the parents say, no, we're not going to do this, and the kid's going to die of a very simple problem to fix. And Dr. Franklin says, screw it, I'm going to do what I want. And he saves the kid. Kid's fine, healthy, no problem. Parents come in, see the kid's healthy. The parents come in and see that he's had the surgery performed on him. And now they say, well, this is just an empty vessel. This means nothing. And they actually end up killing their own son. It's depressing as hell.
Right.
But powerful. You know, it's obviously just an allegory for, you know, medicine and technology versus people's personal beliefs.
Yeah.
And they do a good job of showing you both sides. I think everybody who watches it ultimately wants that kid to live, because who wouldn't? But it's, you know, it's well written. Mm-hmm. Medical drama, moral ambiguity, what do you do? And it has, sorry if it's a spoiler alert for everybody there, but it has a sad ending.
It could have been an episode of House as well as it could have been an episode.
Yes.
They could have been from like some Asian country that nobody, or South American country that nobody, you know, knows what they believe and stuff in some other culture. Yeah, it's really powerful, very profound. By the way, I just have to mention this before I forget. It has one of the great Kosh lines of all time in it. I just love, this is one of the best Kosh lines. And JMS said that David Gerald wrote this line where he says, "The avalanche has already started. It is too late for the pebbles to vote." That is just the best. I love that line. It's a longer line from Kosh. He doesn't usually go into multi-sentence performances, but yeah, that's usually he confines his dialogue to no, but or yes, but yeah, I like that a lot. But no, I don't really, you know, I wrestled with it. We had a good conversation in class about it, but offhand, I don't even remember exactly how I fell on the scale of. I mean, yeah, clearly you want the kid to live. You just want to grab the parents and shake them. But on the other hand, you don't want the man telling people how to live their lives and their culture. I you know, mm-hmm. it's tough.
It is tough.
Yeah. And it also, I always thought, I don't think it gives anything away to say that we don't revisit this again. This is a one-off story, very episodic, to tell a sort of a moral tale. But it would have been interesting to me if Crusade had continued. I think that show in particular, since it had a medical angle to it too, it would have been interesting to have an episode of Crusade where another alien from this same race is in, now that, you know, let's say that this race gets integrated with the Earth Alliance and with the other, you know, with the non-aligned worlds and everything, and they're involved with Earth. It would have been interesting to have an episode of Crusade where an alien from this race decides that anybody who's had surgery is basically a zombie. And so they go around searching medical records to find out who's had surgery and then goes around killing them. And they have to track that person down because he's killing people all over the place because they've had surgery. He thinks he's a crusader taking out the zombies, you know. He thinks he's doing a great thing.
That's a great concept.
Well, we don't get enough Crusade to have ever done it. I don't know they ever would have, but that just
occurred
to me.
Yeah. What is Crusade?
Oh, the follow-up show to Babylon 5.
Didn't know there was one.
Oh, I sent you the episodes, I think, the links or whatever. You have them. Are you, no, not yet. You haven't got them yet, but I have them for you, basically.
What?
Yeah, Babylon 5 ran for 5 years as planned, and then TNT, I believe it was, said, "We want to do another show now." And JMS says, "Well, I have this other story set with different characters in the same universe, and it's called Crusade. And it ran for 13 episodes, but it was canceled before it ever aired the very first time." That was the Gary Cole show.
Okay. I got nothing on that.
Some people hate it. Some people love it. I dearly love it. And we'll get to it after we finish Babylon 5.
All right. Gary Cole, you say?
Yeah, he's the captain. And he's a great captain.
Yeah, I'm going to need you to work on the bridge on Saturday.
It was about the same time, actually, that he filmed Crusade about the same time that they made Office Space, right around that same time, yeah. So, God, I love. But Gary Cole is so great as a captain. He is such
it's
a great
It's just that
Starship
we're putting captain. The new covers on our Babylon 5 reports. And
oh, yeah.
Oh, all right, I look forward to this.
Yeah, it has him and Peter Woodward, so you can't go wrong there. Basically, he's like King Arthur, and Peter Woodward's like Merlin. It's a great, great, great concept. Well, so I don't know. There's a lot going on in this episode for that one plot. I don't remember if there's a lot of B or C plots either. I think there's again another one where that was pretty much the whole story.
Yeah, they hung around on this one a lot. Like I said, I liked it a lot. Which is weird because I'm not usually a big fan of quote unquote preachy episodes, but even this wasn't really preachy. It was, you know, ambiguous. Just like you, I'm sure you talked about in your religion class. It's it's not really hitting you over the head with some message. It's just like basically the message is, man, life is tough. You know, that's basically the message.
Yeah.
But what I really love. This is my favorite things, is episodes that give us big character development. And I knew almost nothing about Franklin going into this, and now I know a lot.
Yeah.
So that's why I really enjoy it. I love character development episodes, so I've got a better handle on Franklin. And I like him a lot. I'm not necessarily sure what I would have done in his position, but I like his character.
A couple of things that JMS said about this episode that are worth noting really quickly as we wrap it up. JMS was asked if the parents were charged with murder by any government. And he says, no, the parents were not charged with murder. When a species on the station acts against one of their own kind in a particular way and no other species is affected, then they are judged by the laws that apply only to their species and culture. In their culture, what they did is not a crime, so they receive no punishment. Had they done this to a human, then they would have been charged with murder. He says, I think that David's script walked a very fine line and really didn't endorse either side. I've had people send me email that were upset because we showed the parents were right. Others were upset because we said the doctor was right, and others because neither was right and the ambiguity bothered them.
Welcome to life.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. And he says that he thought, JMS, I can't find it, but it, yeah, here it is. He says, Somebody said that the episode argues the doctor was right. He says, I disagree. Says who? Not the parents, not the episode. Nobody was really right when you come down to it, except maybe Sinclair, who made the correct call. You say the boy was okay at the end. The parents didn't think so. Who's to say if there was or wasn't a soul inside?
Yeah.
Again, I appreciate this episode a whole lot more now than I did when I first saw it, and it's a pretty powerful statement. And it's another reason why I tell people don't skip season one, because, yeah, I mean, season one doesn't have the Star Wars stuff going on that you get in later, you know, episodes that I'm kind of excited about from that standpoint. But season one has some great standalone episodes like Deathwalker, like Believers, that ask interesting questions and kind of leave them hanging there for you. And that's cool.
Yeah. It makes you think, man. It makes you think. It stays with you.
It really does. So
I will remember this episode probably to the end of my days.
Yeah, yeah, man. So, and I'll probably show it to my religion class before it's over again. Okay, so any last thoughts about any of these four before we wrap up?
No, I think we did a good job on it. I'm excited to learn more about the story arcs. I'm most excited to learn more about are obviously what happened with Sinclair and his missing 24 hours, obviously. And it's still on my mind about what's going on with Kosh and why he felt it was necessary to record the mind readers.
Talia.
What's her name?
Talia Winters.
Talia Winters. Record Talia's you know, fears and thoughts and whatnot. So those are the two big story arcs that caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens.
Let's see. In our next episode, which hopefully will be a lot sooner, and we've also got to, of course, do we'll be doing a Quantum Leap next, so Quantum Leap fans can be happy that we haven't forgotten about you. And I'm looking forward to watching some more of those. But in our next Babylon 5 episode, while I've got it open, we'll be looking at Survivors, which I think is maybe another D'Attilio episode, By Any Means Necessary, Signs and Portents, and TKO. Now, I would say that two or three of those are blah to okay, but with character stuff that's very good. And one of them is another kaboom. Kaboom, I say.
You say kaboom.
And so what's fun is seeing Jared figuring out which ones are which. So
I'll be like, Kosh, all will be revealed in time.
It will. It will. And that's the fun of this for me, is that not only just experiencing the enjoyment of this show after, you know, 20-something years, but, you know, getting your thoughts and your reactions as you see it for the first time is just a whole lot of fun. It lets me kind of watch it again for the first time. So I'm very much
enjoying this. It's Babylon 5 with normies is what
it is. That's what it is. That's a brilliant point. Yeah. All right. So we'll be doing those four. And then we got Grail Eyes, Legacies. We may have to, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, it works out. We'll just have to split a two-parter in half there. That'll be kind of weird, but okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll wrap up for this time. I've got the air conditioner repairman coming over in a minute, so I'm going to get on out of here. And, Jared, I thank you for coming on board, and we'll get back together again either for we're going to do a show. Just a note for our listeners that Jared and Mark Buskett and I are planning to do Kingdom of Heaven, the great Ridley Scott movie. We're going to do a one-shot review of that movie that we've all recently watched or rewatched. We're just trying to get the scheduling down because it gets a little harder with three people and with Halloween coming up and with my wife's birthday that weekend and all. So we're working on it, but hopefully in the next week or so, week to 2 weeks, we'll be able to have a show about Kingdom of Heaven. So, Jared, thanks a bunch, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm enjoying the ride.
All right. And the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another episode, and we'll see you guys down the road.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.